Hello, my name is Craig Schreiner, and I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be in Spark. I just want to thank the committee for asking me, Ron, for patience in trying to switch those phone calls. But had a nice flight in this morning. I started in Indianapolis, actually, and ended up in Sacramento. I wanted to make the drive from there up through the mountains. And I was glad I had that opportunity because it was really beautiful and gave me some time to reflect and think and get lost a few times. But it was interesting as I was coming up over the pass and I was seeing these markers along the sides of the road. I guess that's to, you know, show how high the snow gets and keep the plow trucks lined up. And I was just thinking to myself as I was looking at all these boulders and all these different trees that, you know, for, what, 6 months out of the year, maybe they're sitting under snow and they're just packed in there and they're frozen. And it's kind of the way I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just, I was on ice when I got here and just barely moving. And as I look out and see all these different kinds of faces out here, males and females and neuters and, you know, all the different ones we've got out here, you all remind me of all those different individual trees and boulders on that drive that I saw. You know, we're all similar, but yet different. And it seems like the sunlight of AA sort of melts all that sun away, and we get a chance to grow and really get a chance to dig our roots in. And I enjoyed that today very, very much, that drive. The disease that I have is alcoholism, and it's a fourfold disease. I have to drink alcohol to physically react to it. I have, and I am convinced I have, an allergy that I just can't really explain it, but when I drink, I lose control. It's like certain people that go out and inhale air at certain times of the year, and there's pollen or different things, and, you know, their eyes water, and they can't breathe, and they cough, and, you know, I don't call them social outcasts and not hang around with them and tell them if they only had a little willpower, they could get their life together, you know, and, I mean, what the hell is wrong with you, you know? I mean, put that Kleenex down, you know? But that's what I have. I have an allergy. I just don't know what's going to happen when I drink. That's the problem. It's a mental disease, really. If left alone and left to my own devices, I will lie to myself and I will exaggerate the truth. And basically, in this mental aspect of this disease, I lived a life of delusion, actually believing in something that wasn't right, that I don't have this allergy. You know, I believed that. I really believed it. And I believed that someday, somehow, somewhere, I could drink normally, or that there would be some sort of a cure, and when the pollen came out, you know, my eyes wouldn't water, or when I drank, I wouldn't lose control. But I was under a delusion. I believed something that absolutely wasn't true. It's an emotional disease. The day that I got drunk, when I was 13 years old, and what that alcohol did to me, I will never forget. But at that point in time, I didn't need to grow up anymore. I didn't need to deal with envy or jealousy or anger or resentment or fears. All I had to do was drink. And it just smoothed out that emotional turbulence and made me feel as if I fit, just like a hand in a glove. And emotionally, when I got sober at 26, I was still about 13 years old, maybe 12, I don't know. But I do know that I had to grow up. It was a big part of it. And last but not least, this disease is a spiritual disease. And that I really did cut myself off from that sunlight that I was talking about today that sort of melts away all the snow and the ice. I had no place in my life for God. I had no reason to believe in a power greater than myself. I had no want of feeling part of a community or spiritually attached to anything. I wanted to be hermetically attached to a bottle of whiskey. I mean, that was my higher power. That's all I needed was that. The thing that my sponsor pointed out to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous were 9 paragraphs on 3 different parts of the big book. I was just sort of breezing back through those things. And the first part he wanted to show me was on page 27, where Dr. Young was talking to Roland, that chronic alcoholic case that felt as if the gates of hell had just collapsed on top of him or opened up or whatever it said, when this great psychiatrist told him that there really was not much that he could do. And he was just pleading with him in desperation, "Are you sure there are no exceptions?" And Dr. Young looks at him and says, "No anxiety, breath. You know, I'm sorry, we just, I have chronic cases like yours." "Well, yeah," he says, "there have been certain things in the past that have created some sort of a change or a rearrangement. And it's a spiritual experience. And that's what I've been trying to invoke inside of you, is this spiritual experience. The attitudes, ideas, and emotions that are the guiding forces in your life have to be cast aside. And
you got to get a new philosophy of living here. And you basically have to change your thinking 180 degrees. And that word spiritual experience is italicized. And it's in squiggly little letters. And at the bottom of that page, it says, see spiritual appendix. So my sponsor said, let's go see the spiritual appendix. So that's page 570. He showed me just two paragraphs there that he felt were important that I know. And that was the indispensables to this spiritual experience were honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to change. Those were indispensable. They were key, but more importantly, they were indispensable. And, and then he also said, read the last paragraph there, and it's a little quote from a philosopher at the time, Hubert Spencer, but it basically says that if you want to stay in everlasting ignorance for the rest of your life, just maintain an attitude of, contempt prior to investigation. I immediately said to my sponsor, yeah, but... and there it went. I mean, my mind was shut, I would not let new ideas in. Every sentence that I started in my first year of sobriety started with yeah, but. It was just automatic. No matter if someone paid me a compliment, or if someone was criticizing me, or if someone was trying to help me get on, yeah, but. And I always had my mind closed. And he was careful to point that out. Last but not least, he wanted to point out to me on page 45 what the dilemma was with the disease of alcoholism. And I'll never forget the day I read that and actually understood it. It was 22 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the lack of power that was the dilemma. Alcohol was only a symptom. And that I had to be put in touch with a power greater than myself to help me deal with my problem. And that power had to be greater than myself. And then there's the shortest sentence in the big book. One word, obviously, period. Now that concludes the intellectual portion of my talk tonight. It goes downhill from here. I have sort of memorized and paraphrased very grossly three main areas in that big book, but it basically tells me what the disease is, what has to happen in order to arrest it, and what are the tools to actually bring about a spiritual experience. And that's kind of easy to memorize, and I read those things, and I read the words, but I don't really think I quite understood exactly what they meant. But I had it up here. But it's taken about 15 years to get it to start to go from here down to here and into the language of the heart and to really understand the spirit of what is being said in there and not the letter and the context and understanding the words. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, and I remember one day when it snowed intensely that I went out and shoveled snow. And I was probably 6 years old. A shovel was bigger than I was. And I don't even know where I got the idea. I just thought that it would be great to go out and shovel snow and make some money. And I shoveled our walk, and I couldn't even believe I did it, because it was really the first big chore I ever did. And I got it done. And my mom said, the lady across the street called, and she wanted to know, would you shovel her walk? So I went across the street and told her I'd do it for a quarter or something like that, and shoveled the walk, and she paid me my money, and she said, the lady on the night next to me called, and she wanted to know, would you come over and shovel this walk? Well, I got another referral, and so I just kept, going all the way down the street. Now, I was outside for several hours that day, and I just didn't stop shoveling snow, and people were giving me, hot chocolate and nourishment, and I just kept shoveling snow. Well, at the end of the day, I had $6 or $7. Now, this is, 35 years ago, and that was a lot of money. I mean, that was a lot of money. That was more money than I ever had in my whole life. $6, $7, and quarters were real heavy then, and had 50-cent pieces, and it was just really heavy. But I remember I had all that money, and a thought occurred to me: you better get home. Mom's worried. I know that supper's going to be served, and I should put this in the piggy bank. And then this other thing in my mind said, well, wait a second, we got to go down and celebrate. And all of a sudden, I remembered about Blackie's, and Blackie's was the soda fountain. And it was beautiful. I mean, as a kid, can you remember walking into the older soda fountains, and it had the marble counter, big, beautiful leather swivel seats, a mirror behind the, the thing where all the spigots were to just sort of describe a situation, something that we're all comfortable. And so I remember blowing into this place saying, hey, everybody, Coke's on me. And I was passing out money everywhere, and I was buying everybody Cokes, and saw some little girl sitting on the end of the counter and said, hey, here's 50 cents. Get yourself a hot fudge sundae, baby, And I was spending all my money. I was little big shot. That's what I was. I was little big shot. And I, before the day was out, I blew all the money. And I remember I saw behind me this rack of models in boxes. And a kid that I idolized in my neighborhood lived next to me, and he was about 16. He drove a really hot car, and we just thought he was the coolest thing in the world. And he had I got to go up in his room one day, and he had models. He had cars and airplanes from the Second World War and battleships, and I was so impressed. Well, here I saw one of these giant models. Except the problem was that this model was for someone who's probably, you know, built these things for 10 years and had about 250 parts and really had, I had no business as a six-year-old buying that part, but I looked at the little models for the kids that were six, and they looked, you know, they just didn't look as impressive. Plus, there was this big blonde on the cover with a little teeny bathing suit on leaning on this hot car, and I fell in love with her instantly. Immediately I fell in love with her, and I had to have that box. So the lady got this thing down. Easy. Keep coming back. I remember taking this box home, and I remember all these dreams as I'm dragging it through the snow, and I'm thinking, my God, if I put this thing together, Barry is going to think I'm cool. All the kids at school, when I take it there, are going to go, look what he did. You know, it's show and tell. My mom's going to think, what a son. I mean, look, he goes out and earns all this money, and he can make this model, and my dad will be proud. Well, I remember having all these expectations, and I went upstairs, and I ripped open this thing, and I put that woman was going to watch me every move I made. You know, she was going to watch me. And I started looking at all these parts, and I couldn't believe how many there were. I had them scattered all over the room. And then I had decals in the water, and they were floating, and all of a sudden I realized, after about 2 hours of trying to put this thing together, I made a mess of this thing. I didn't have it. Nothing seemed to fit. And I was getting frustrated. I started to cry. I was thinking, oh, my God, I've wasted all this money. I don't have anything to show for it. And I was just getting into all this self-pity and this low self-esteem or whatever. And I'll never forget, I was ready to go downstairs to just sort of complain to my dad or to tell him what a failure I'd made out of this thing. And as I was walking away, my foot was stuck on something, and I look, and it's the instructions. Now, what's the point? You know, the point is that if you use humility in life, and if you ask for help, and if you, you know, read the instructions, and if you approach anything with any degree of humility, you can accomplish things. But I had no room in my life for instructions. That object lesson went right over my head, but yet today I still remember it. God was trying to get a hold of me at that age. I didn't want anything to do with it. All I remember was my impatience. All I remember was my disappointment. All I remember was my high level of energy and excitement of trying all this grandiosity. That's all I can remember. Now take that same little person, that same little, you know, ball of energy with a little flame inside burning, and throw something flammable on it like alcohol. And the first drink that I had when I was 13 years old, we stole a case of beer out of a garage, and the guys were sleeping out by, you know, out in the woods. And I can remember having about the third beer, and it was sort of warm, and I remember I really hated the taste of this stuff, but after about the third one, I kind of remember looking at that fire burning, and I just sort of remember being a little mesmerized by the flame. All of a sudden, I started to realize, my God, I'm feeling just as warm as that fire, man. This is great. And all of a sudden, I just saw, you know, all these smiling faces, and next thing I know, it's just dark and quiet, and I'm feeling, God, what is that smell, I'm thinking, and where am I? And I'm hearing these people's voices, but I can't see anything. And all of a sudden I realize that there's urine on me, and there's other, you know, sorts of, you know, think of any excretion, it's on me, okay? I mean, it's somewhere, it's on me, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. All of a sudden I realize that I'm in my sleeping bag head first. And I'm kind of like a caterpillar trying to come out of a cocoon or something like that, you know? And I finally made it out, and here I am. I remember I was really, the head was going like this, and my stomach was really, really upset. And it's the next day, and I got my tennis shoes on, and my blue jeans are in a tree smoking on fire, and my buddies are like you. They're laughing at me, you know, and they're thinking, God, were you funny last night? And that's all I heard. As soon as they said, God, were you funny last night? You were the funniest thing we ever saw. I forgot that there was every excrement in the world on me. I was naked. I only had my tennis shoes on. I was ready to throw up, and I had a headache, and I didn't remember a thing. But they said you were funny. And that was what I held on to with respect to alcohol. That's what it did to me the very first time, and it never stopped doing that. It just required more effort and more time and different ways and different methods and different moods. And I kept that up, and I can remember at the age of 21, with tears in my eyes, talking to my college buddies at a table that I think I'm an alcoholic because I haven't been able to not drink for like 6 years. And in college, I traveled and studied in 20-some different countries, and I don't even remember half of them. And I remember just tears in my eyes. I think I'm an alcoholic. So I needed to prove something, so I went about 50 miles into the Deschutes National Forest in Oregon, and I didn't drink for 2 days. Of course, you couldn't find any alcohol 50 miles into the Deschutes Forest for 50, you know, for 2 days. And I was so happy that I drank beer on the way home from that camping trip. You know, I just remembered how happy I was. And then I continued to live in that delusion that someday it's going to be different. So I can control this. It's going to work. Somehow I called AA when I was 24 years old, the first day of my real, quote, first job. And the very first thing I said, because the person in our group answered very quickly, and I was not ready for it, I said, "I have a friend who has a drinking problem." I mean, that is awful. And she said, "Tell your friend to call us." And I hung up. Now, I said, I just hung up. Now, about 2 or 3 weeks later, I remember laying on my bed and in a complete state of total fear and sense of impending doom, and terror and bewilderment are sleeping with me, and confusion's at my feet. And, you know, I mean, there's the scene. It's 6 a.m, and I have to grab the whiskey bottle and start drinking. And 6:30 in the morning, not knowing what happened the day before, got a mouthful of Seagram 7 whiskey, and your stomach is just said to the brain, "Don't you dare send that down here, you fool. What is wrong with you?" And the mouth is just exploding, and it's killing all those germs and from wherever my mouth was the night before. And I can remember all the, you know, the heart starting to race and the sweat starting to come, and I'm thinking to myself, "I got to do something with this." And the stomach is saying, "Don't you dare send that down here." And then going, and you get one of those. Remember those? Ooh, he just twitched back there. Yeah! You're one of us, buddy. And you get one of those, you know, and then it just goes from here down into the stomach, and before my feet had even touched the floor, I was already another prisoner, slave to alcohol again. And I promised myself, and I promised everybody that I knew and loved, that I wouldn't do this again, and here it was, bingo, 26 years of age. And what have I done with myself? And I remember my parents just bought a freezer or a refrigerator somewhere at Sears, and they met this nice man who was in AA. And wouldn't I like to talk to him? No. And he sent him over anyhow. And Fred was 66 years old, and he shows up at my house, and I'm 26, and he's 66, and kind of looked a little startled when he saw me, because at this time, about 16 years ago, there weren't a lot of us that, you know, under 30, but there were, in California, of course, there were lots of them, but, you know, what the heck. I said, "Gee, I don't know what I'm going to do with you." And I said, "I'll just, you know, let's go to a meeting." So he took me up to St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. And he took me up to the top ward where Bill and Bob used to take, you know, the newcomers when they came. And I never forget going up to the top floor, and the elevator opens, and there is a picture of Sister Mary Resentment. You know, that's what I'm... There she is, you know. Boom. Staring me right in the eyes. I forgot all about church for 20-some years, and there she is, Sister Ignatia, looking me right in the face, you know. So he takes me over to the ward where the guys are, you know, and I walk over and I see all these guys standing around with their butts hanging out of these things, and they're all getting vitamin B something or other shots. This is what these guys do now, you know. They go and they get shots of vitamin B. And then he sat me down, and there was a little 45 record player and some Elvis Presley records. He said, "Well, you could listen to a few of these if you want." I'm thinking, right. Went to a meeting that night, didn't hear a thing that girl said, and all I remember is this one guy with no teeth and a Camel cigarette that stuck and stayed right in there perfectly would be looking at me and talking like this with the smoke coming out, and he would be telling me why they call it the Arid Club, because we don't drink. It's arid. It means dry. And I'm going, "That's right, bimbo, you know. Oh, look, we have a camel for a logo. Isn't that great? Goes 30 days without drinking, you know." And I went home and I drank on the way home from that. I went out for another year and a half. And at the age of 26, on March 6, 1978, I fell down on my knees and I was done. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'd known since I was 21 years of age that this wasn't right, that I was an alcoholic, but I was living under the delusion that something would, that somehow, somewhere I was different. And I said 3 words, and I meant it: "God, help me." And he has. I'd like to say that this is the part of my talk where, you know, it becomes real uplifting, but I can remember going into the detox unit, and I knew the medical director. We used to play golf together, and I immediately wanted, you know, some sort of special treatment, and when he found out that I was in there, he had me shipped out that night. This guy knows how to, he knows how to work with drunks. And I went to... No, I didn't go to Hope Valley or Let's Get Fun and Sober or, you know, the Easy Does It Farm, or, you know, or New Life, New Beginning, you know. I went to a sanitarium called Molly Stark. Now, that was the name of a woman, a nurse. Molly, now picture in your mind, Molly Stark, you know. She was this Puritan nurse that wore burlap corsicas or whatever those things are, you know. You know, it looked like that. I remember clouds formed over this place when we drove in, but it was a sanitarium. It was right in the middle of Ohio, and it was really sort of a castle-like structure. It was really old, had bars on the windows, and it had severely retarded adults that were really, you know, just uncontrollable, and there were terminally ill people with cancer and leukemia, and there were it was a horrible place. I mean, it was scary. It smelled. There were weird noises at night on the second and third floor, and, you know, we weren't on the third floor. The alcoholic ward was in the basement. That's where the alcoholic ward, we're underneath all these people, you know. And I stayed in my room for 3 days. As pompous and conceited and as phony as I was better than you. I was in this place, but I was better than you. And I stayed in my room, and I wasn't going to sit out there on the table with the rest of them. I was going to stay right in my room, and that's what I did. For 3 days, I didn't come out. Now, they said that when I had to leave here eventually, and that when I did, that if I would go to AA meetings, I probably stood the best chance of staying sober in the long run, and that maybe I'd be interested in talking to a sponsor. Whatever. Send them down. So they sent this guy down, and I remember I was a little impressed. He drove like an hour and 10 minutes from Akron down just to talk to me. Didn't even know who I was. But when he started talking, and his face started sweating about, chasing his wife around the bed with a butcher knife, and this guy was reliving this experience, you know, and I'm listening to him, you know. And, I mean, I don't know if he'd quite worked through that resentment yet, but this guy was... Man, I remember going, wait a second, you know, and I left. And I went down the hall, and I knocked on the counselor's office, and I said, Donna, I said, can we have a choice in sponsors? Is this my guy, you know? I mean, she said, no, he just came down to talk, and she said, I'll send someone else down tomorrow. Hollis is coming down. You'll like Hollis. So, now, the next day, this elderly gentleman walked into my room, and he had a beautiful tweed coat on, and he had a pipe with very aromatic tobacco in it, and he had a really nice clean shirt and a tie on, and had some nice soft loafers, and Hollis was a professor of law. Now, moi could have a sponsor who was a professor of law. You know, I could see that, and of course we all need a good attorney when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought that he would really fit the bill. And we had the greatest relationship. My sponsor and I had the greatest relationship. We really did. I never called him. He never called me. And it was that way for a long time. And all I did was what I knew what was best. I read it in Bill's story, and it was I played golf 6 days a week, and I went to one meeting. Well, Bill did. If you read his story, it's where, you know, he played golf just about every day, and he was, you know, impeccable coat of tan. He was, of course, he was bouncing bad checks, and this is the part where he was qualifying to be the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Had nothing to do with his recovery in AA, but I wasn't quite focused yet enough to pick that up. But I was playing golf alone and, you know, enjoying that. Now, I can remember one day I heard Hollis had a heart attack, and so it occurred to me that I should go see him in the hospital, because he was going to have an operation the next day. So I went down to Akron City Hospital, and sure enough, there he was in a critical care unit, and he was going to have a bypass operation the next day, on Sunday. And he was glad. When I walked in the room, I could remember his face. He was glad to see me. I just remember that feeling that I got from him. And he said, it's nice to see you. He says, I'm glad you're here. He says, you know, I've been wondering about you, and it's time that you get busy. And at this point, I've been around AA about 18 months. And he said, you really do need to dig your heels in now and get started. And I said, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, Hollis. Tomorrow, somehow I got roped into being a moderator on a panel called Gratitude Sunday in Akron. And it was old-timers that would talk once a year. And, I mean, these people were sponsored by Bill and Bob. And, I mean, they had real legacy and a hook into AA's history. And I was somehow going to moderate this panel. And he said, well, that's great that you're going to do that. And I said, well, where's your operation? He said, well, it'll be 3 o'clock tomorrow. So I remember as working in that small role of service to moderate this panel, that I looked at my watch, and it was 3 o'clock, and I said a prayer for Hollis. I remember doing that. I mean, that was the first time I ever said a prayer for anybody. I really meant it, you know. And then I remember going home that night, and I decided, well, I'll call his wife, Flo, and see how he did. So I called her, and I said, how are you? And she said, not real good. She said, Hollis died today. She said, he died a little after 3 o'clock. And all of a sudden, I just realized, my God, this man's gone. And this is a man I never even used. I didn't even really know him. And he was one of the founders of one of the greatest AA meetings in Akron, a men's Tuesday night Hilltop, an absolutely outstanding meeting. And he had he had umpteen years of sobriety, and he worked a serious program. I never even tapped into this resource. And I was thinking, my God, he's gone. Something happened. And I said, Flo, can I help you? Is there anything that I can do? And she said, my God, yes. She just broke into tears, and she said, could you just come over? I don't know what to do with the kids tomorrow for school, and I got to make arrangements, and I don't have anything in the refrigerator. So I remember getting milk and bread and all this stuff and brought it over, and I just put the kids to bed and helped console her and started making phone calls and started, you know, doing bills and making. And for the next 3 days, I just did whatever she needed done. I did it. And I didn't even think about myself for 1 second. And I remember after that period that I ended up burying my sponsor, I'll never forget the hundreds of people that showed up at this funeral. Deans from the University of Akron and prominent people in Akron society showed up, as well as drunks and thousands, hundreds of members from AA. And here I realized was a great resource that I never used. And just a little bit past this time, I remember I was doing my recovery, which was, you know, playing golf. I was playing golf alone and cheating. That's what I did. Think about that for a second. Playing golf alone and cheating. Now, who am I cheating? I mean, really. If you look up the word denial in the dictionary, there's a picture of me there with a golf club in my hand, you know. No words, you know, but denial. There it is. You know, what do you mean it doesn't count, Craig? You missed it. You count the stroke, you know. So there I was, playing alone and cheating, and I realized I was on a par 5 hole. I hit a tee shot out, and I was standing over this second shot. And I saw there were people on the green down there. And I realized, well, they're so far away on this par 5, there's no way that I can hit them. As a matter of fact, I'll take a precaution, and I won't even try to hit it that far. I'll sort of lay up, and I hit a 5-wood instead. Now, I also took a couple of minutes to think about this golf shot, because what's the hurry? These people are on the green, I'm thinking. Because all I used to do with golf when I first started, when I got sober, was just grab the club and swing the ball as hard as you can. I mean, that's how you do everything, isn't it? You just squeeze it like hard, and you impose your will on it, you know? And that's how I played golf, and I cheated, and I didn't count all the strokes, you know. And well, then all of a sudden I realized, I read this couple of articles or something by a guy named Jack Nicklaus, you know. I guess he was pretty good at this game. And Nicklaus had this thing where it says, take an inventory of the shot you want to hit before you hit it. Project in your mind what you want to do and try to visualize it. Take a visual inventory. And then I actually took a club that wouldn't even hit the ball that far. I actually, for the first time in a year and a half playing golf, I took a humble approach to my first golf swing. And I took a 5-wood. And I remember standing behind the ball and trying to project in my mind the swing that I wanted. And I just remember going back like this real smooth and just go. I look at this thing and I'm going, my God, look at that. I never hit a shot like this in my life. I'm thinking, did I hit the right club? And I turn over and I said, yeah, it's a 5-wood. And I'm going, my God. All of a sudden I realize it's so far that it's going to hit the green where these people are. Far! And this guy jumps over like this, and the ball goes flying right by him. Now, I almost hit him with the golf ball. I could have killed this little guy. So I'm walking up to the green, getting ready to get thrown off the golf course, because that's poor etiquette. I mean, I did not read the book of etiquette or in golf, you know, these things. I was just out. And just before I was ready to apologize to this guy, it was this new guy I saw at the meeting I'd go to one time a week. And I'll never forget seeing this guy just like 2 weeks earlier. He was over in a corner of the room, and he had his coat off, and it was hanging over his left arm, and his tie was undone, his collar was unbuttoned, and he had a Pall Mall cigarette stuck on his lip. And it had an ash on it. How does that ash stay on there? You know, I always wanted to go like this, and he'd be talking everything, and that ash would still be stuck on there. He must have knew the guy with the camel with the teeth, you know, and the hole in his thing. Well, at any rate, I went flying across the room, and I stuck my hand out, and I said, hi, my name is Craig. You keep coming back to these meetings, these people can help you. And then I just went on my self-centered little whirlwind way, you know. People were saying, hi, Craig, how you doing? I said, great, wonderful, fantastic, and I hated you, and I hated AA, and I was going to one meeting a week, and I was better than you, and I was a phony, and there I am, walking up to the green to apologize to this person that I almost killed. I am a walking big book, folks. I am, you know, 18 months dry, and just as I was ready to apologize to this new guy, he goes, nice shot! Now, I immediately forgot about the apology and said, well, yeah, thank you. Yes, it was a tremendous shot, wasn't it? That was a 5-wood. Did you know that? And instead of throwing me off, he said, would you like to join us? And I said, well, my gosh, I'd be glad to. So we finished out the round. Now, my brain kicked into gear, and it said, he's new, take him to a meeting. So I asked him, would you like to go to a meeting? And he said, sure.
So we get in the car, and I'm driving him to this meeting, and it was Saturday night. We're going to the Copley meeting, and I'm saying, now we're going to a it's a speaker meeting, and at speaker meetings they have people who chair and so on. Then we have discussion meetings, and we have men meetings, and there's women meetings. We're not allowed to go to those for obvious reasons, you know. And I'm explaining to him, Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him about intergroup, and I was thinking to myself, where is intergroup? You know, thought just occurred to me is where is that place? Huh? So we got to the meeting, and it was a really good Saturday night meeting. And after the meeting, my brain kicked into gear again, and it said, fellowship. I've heard that, fellowship. I looked at him, and I said, do you want to get something to eat? He said, sure. So we're driving to the restaurant. Now I'm telling him how to stay sober. Now, you read the big book, and you go to meetings, and you don't drink. Read the big book, go to meetings, don't drink. And I was like this little parrot on his shoulder, you know. But all I knew was bumper sticker sobriety. I didn't know anything else other than, you know, easy does it, go to meetings and don't drink. That was... So we get to the restaurant, and I've already ordered, and I'm carrying on. I took a bite out of my sandwich. Now I'm chewing it. This is the first time since I've met this person that he actually gets a chance to say something. And he asked me about something that was in the big book on a certain page, and I'm chewing and thinking to myself, boy, I don't have any idea what he's talking about. I sort of sloughed that off, you know, swallowed a little hard, you know. Then he asked me about something that was in a 12 and 12. And I'm thinking to myself, what is a 12 and 12? And my mind kicks into gear for the third time this night, and it said, maybe he's not new. So I said, hey, how long have you been in AA? Just about that loud in a public restaurant. Now, I've almost killed him with a golf ball today, right? And now I've blown his anonymity in a public place. And he looked me square in the eyes, and he said, I don't know, a reasonable length of time, Craig. What else do you know is in the big book? And I said, seriously now, how long have you been in AA? I don't know, 16, maybe 17 years. Now, this person that I was going to sponsor, today he's my sponsor. That's how I met my sponsor. I'm 18 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, dry, self-centered, little pompous whirlwind, and I don't know the difference between someone who's got 17 days and 17 years. Look up the word sick in the dictionary. And there's a picture of me. Now, this was at a point where Hollis had died, and I never forget realizing at this point when I was amazed with this man, and he started to talk. Well, he just moved to Akron from Sacramento, California, where he got sober. That's why I'd never seen him before, and I assumed that he was new, and et cetera, and so on. Well, this guy started talking about things in the big book and steps and how you do this and dictionaries and things that I really never, ever heard of. And my sponsor, who I never used, had died just a couple weeks earlier. And I was thinking to myself, well, this guy really is, I mean, he's interesting. He really knows what he's talking about. And I asked him, I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, why? And I'm thinking to myself, because I asked you. If you look up the word pompous in the dictionary, there's a picture of me there. But what he was trying to do was cause me to think. He wanted to know, why did I want him as a sponsor? He wasn't being facetious. Are you attracted to something into me? Is there something I've said that you like? Do I demonstrate something that appeals to you? Do you even have a clue as to why you want me to be your sponsor? But he said, I want you to get a dictionary, Craig. I'm thinking to myself, a what? A dictionary. I speak out of respect for George. George is a Cajun. He's from New Orleans. He looks like Yoda. He's 100 years old. He's been sober 30-some years. I mean, he's... But I love him and respect him. So I got a dictionary, and he said, I want you to look up two words. We and I. And I was insulted. Who doesn't know the difference between we and I? And he looked at me and said, you. You got to Alcoholics Anonymous. We are going to keep you sober. And I got his point. Started at the self-centeredness. Because all my world was I. There was no we. And my sponsor assumes nothing. And so I started to become friends with this dictionary, not with my sponsor, with the dictionary, and I began to look up these words. And I remember we went through the first three steps, and we talked about it, and we went right as the book talks.
And we got to the fourth step. And then, you know, the major items that all I want to talk about tonight, because we don't have time to go into the other items. But I can remember driving over there to do my fifth step with George. And I remember I was at a stop sign just outside of Talmadge. And I was thinking to myself, I could turn around. Turn around. You don't need to do this. You've written this thing, but, you know, you don't need to go talk to this person. I mean, and I was scared, and I didn't want to go talk about all these things, but I just remember I drove through, and I went on, and there I sat. And we talked about the main items. That's all I want to talk about tonight. And basically, resentment. The number one offender. Numero uno. Did you like the word I'm trying, he'd said. Yes, George, I looked the word up. What's it mean? I said, well, the best I can determine it means to refill the hurt of the past. Craig, why do you want to live in the past? Now, I was just getting ready to read to him about 47 justified resentments, and he talks to me about just living in the past. Never occurred to me. Why do I want to live in the past? And he began to show me in about several places in that big book that all my resentments, they were all my own doing. Somewhere I either thought about it, provoked it. It was my inventory, not yours, not my mom's, not the police, not my dad's, not the school. It was my inventory. What could I do to change? Where was I at fault? What did I have to do? And I'll never forget when I went through all those resentments and didn't point the finger at anyone else in there and accepted that truth about myself. And I remember swallowing that stuff I never wanted to swallow. It went down and it stayed down. It wasn't like that whiskey at 6:30 in the morning. It felt good. And then, when I wasn't, you know, fearing or resenting the past, I was fearing the future. So we started to talk about fears. Okay, didn't you like the word up? And sure enough, I looked up the word fear, and I gathered my own little definition, and it basically means to live in the future. To somehow try to enact or bring about occurrences that I have no control over that are going to happen. Now, the very first thing that happened to me when I went to Molly Stark, March 7th, was what am I going to do at the Christmas party 10 months from now when everybody knows I'm not drinking? 10 months ahead of myself, the very first day in recovery. Why do you want to live in the future, Craig? And so I began to see, as we read in the text and looked at things, that fear are a lack of faith. Simply a lack of faith. That every day I come to AA, I get more faith that I can stay sober, and I see others that come around me in AA, and I watch them come to AA, and they give me faith that they can stay sober, and so the more faith that I get, the less fear I have. Now, when I wasn't resenting the past or fearing the future, I had guilt about sex. And I remember I came to that part in my inventory where I had to read the sex stuff. And I started reading like this, and I started reading, and I was going through this, and the 5, 5, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, I was going through all this stuff, and I kept reading, I did this, I got through this, and I forget, I stopped, and I looked up, and I was like this, and my sponsor was going, oh, and I caught him yawning. And he said, that was boring, he said. Jeez. And then he told me about parts of his sex life, and my mouth flew open. I'm thinking, my God, he's right, mine was boring. I'm going, I was thinking, I didn't know you could even do those kinds of things, you know, like, isn't that illegal or something, you know? After several hours of talking all in different depths about all the different inventory and the guide that we use in the big book and going through this whole thing, there I stood at the end of that day. I'll never forget it. It was all done. I was exhausted. I'd cried. I'd laughed. I'd cried. I'd laughed. I'd felt things I'd never felt before. I admitted things I never admitted before, and I accepted things I never accepted before. And he said three things to me. I forgive you for everything that you have ever done. And God forgives you for everything that you have done. Now I want you to take the rest of your life to learn to forgive yourself for everything that you've done. And that day, that moment, he planted the seed of self-respect right in me. But for the first time in my life, the ground that was in here was now cultivated. I wasn't yeah-butting this. I wasn't fighting and resisting anything. I had pulled all the weeds. The skeletons were out. The soil had been tilled. The nitrogen was in there. And when the seed hit this time, it took. Now, I'd like to tell you this is the part of my recovery where everything really gets good. But now I started playing golf 6 days a week. And I wasn't going to go empty ashtrays. And I wasn't going to go put chairs up at the meeting. And I would take a new guy to a meeting, what if he throws up in my car? Now I'm going on the happy dry drunk. You know, I'm going to go out and have some fun now. I mean, I'm making money. I've got a steady job. I'm going out with women that can put full sentences together, you know, and talk. And Don't laugh, guys, because the women go out with guys that can put full sentences together, too, after they get sober, you know. I mean, even bring them home and introduce them to your parents. I mean, yeah, that's new. And that's what I wanted to do, and I was on this happy dry drunk, and I was not really, you know, at all too interested in giving back to Alcoholics Anonymous what it had given to me. I was going to have some fun now. For the first time in my life, I could have a golf game. I could think in the present. You know, I wasn't hindered by all these things. And I just didn't want to be bothered with all that. As a matter of fact, I got into this little attitude that I really started to think I knew a lot about AA. I read 164 pages, did a fourth and fifth step, and if you don't do your meeting the way I think you do, your group sucks. And I'm going to gossip about your group. And if you don't read how it works a certain way at the meeting, I'm not coming back to your meeting. If you don't take a four-step a certain way like it says in here, you don't have real sobriety. And I got on this little spiritual dry drunk where a little bit of knowledge and very little experience is dangerous. And I never forget, I got a letter from New York, from Icky Paw, 25th International Young People's Conference. They wanted me to come talk. Of course they did. And I called my... I called my sponsor when I got, I hadn't even read this letter. I just saw it and it said, you know, such as in New York. And I called him up and I was going to read to him. I said, George, you got to hear this. And he interrupted me. Did you look up those words I gave you? And I'm thinking to myself, what words? Pompous, conceited, arrogant, self-centered. And I'm going, what are you talking about? And he tore into me like he never in my whole life. And he was up one side of me and down the other. And he was telling me that the way I was doing, I wasn't giving anything back to meetings. There was a new guy in the meeting last night. And I didn't shake his hand. I didn't know he was there. And you make me sick, he said. You're disgusting. He said, I want you to go to some meetings this week and try to find another sponsor. It's obvious that I don't have what it takes to give anything to you. You're awful. All of a sudden, I realized I was getting fired. All of a sudden, I realized I called this guy to tell him how great I was, and he just fired me. What is something missing here, you know, I'm thinking. So I immediately grabbed the dictionary, you know, and I said, George, I'm looking up the word. Pompous, was it? Oh, yeah, right. Self-centered, conceited, arrogant. Oh, geez, see, arrogant, you know, and I'm looking up arrogant, you know. And I said, okay, and I'm looking these words. I said, George, please don't fire me. I'm sorry. I'm looking up these words. I went to 21 meetings that week. I'll never forget it. I went to every meeting you could possibly go to in Akron, Ohio. I went to it. And I said, George, I went to every meeting in Akron that you can in 1 week, and I didn't find anybody that I want to be my sponsor. Will you still be my sponsor? Will you please not fire me? And he said, okay, don't worry about it. And then he said, what was in that letter you had? Oh, yeah, right. I forgot all about that, you know. So I'm reading this letter. Oh, it's New York and Icky Paw, and they want me to come out. And hey, they want me to be on a panel. What's the topic, he said. Humility. And George has a linoleum floor in his kitchen, and he dropped the phone, and I hear him going, ha, 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 ha. And this wiry old Cajun body is just going convulsions on the floor, and I can just see this little guy laughing his head off, you know. And then he finally gains his composure. You know when you're trying not to laugh and that makes you laugh even harder? And then he gets into one of his coughing fits from three packs of cigarettes a day. Now I think he's going to die. He's going, ah! So he finally gets back on the phone. He gains his composure. He clears his throat and he says, what are you going to say, Craig? And that was another turning point in my sobriety. And at that very day, I'll never forget it, was the day that all of a sudden the new person meant something to me. That was the day that all of a sudden I realized this is serious. That was the day that I began to realize that I called my sponsor to tell him how great I was, and I was this close to a drink and didn't even know it. And that had an impression on me. And now I started to get concerned, and I started to get active, and I started to do things that I never did before. I set up chairs, and I did this, and I did that, and I tried to be as active as I could, and got involved in conferences, and started the sponsor. And I'll never forget one night at our young people's meeting that I saw this kid across the room, long hair hanging all the way down to here, had a t-shirt that was up to here, and the pants that were down to here, you could see the crack in the back, you know, one of those deals. And the belly was hanging out. Now, I know the difference between someone with 17 days and 17 years now. I walk over and I said, hi, my name is Craig. I'm an alcoholic. Is there anything I could do to help you? And he looked up through his hair and he said, my name is Scott. And could you give me a ride home after the meeting? And I said, I'd love to give you a ride home. And I said, as a matter of fact, when I passed the literature table, I said, here, I'll get you one of our owner's manuals. Don't worry about paying us. You know, if you get some money, you can pay us back later. But take this. You need to have this. And it's important. It's how we stay sober.
And I'm driving Scott back to his house, and we're driving into parts of Akron, Ohio that I'd never seen before. And we kept driving and driving, and I'm turning, and all of a sudden I realize there are no more streetlights. I'm realizing that the last six cars I've passed have been completely stripped. I'm getting nervous. I'm starting to see more Harley-Davidsons than telephone poles. I'm starting to see boarded windows. I'm starting to think to myself, where am I taking this guy? And then we pull up into this little driveway, and there was this, the worst house I'd ever seen. And there was someone drunk on the couch out on the front porch, and that was his stepfather. And his sister's baby was like 2 years old. She was just out wandering around in the front yard, filthy. And his mother came out of the house in a big moo-moo, and she was sort of, you know, not looking like she's ready to go out on Saturday night or anything like that, but she was had a big smile, and she said, "Hi, who are you?" And I said, "Well, my name is Craig, and I was at an AA meeting, and I brought Scott home." And Scott said, "Come on in." And I'm going, "No, that's all right. I don't really want to come in." He drags me into the house. He says, "Hey, this is my sister." And it was dark. I remember I couldn't see hardly anything. And then I remember going to the kitchen, and there was just one light in the kitchen, and it was unbelievably dirty. And when we walked across the floor, Scott noticed that I was sort of trying to dodge around different things. And he said, "Hey, isn't this place great?" He said, "We don't use roach motels. When they run across the floor, they get stuck, and then we just step on them." And he was saying these things just to try to make light of where he was. And I told him that I said, "Here, Scott, here's my number. I wrote it in the book, and I said, call me tomorrow and if you want to go to a meeting or something." I'll never forget leaving. I couldn't get out of that house fast enough. And I remember getting in my car and driving to Akron, the nice part where I lived, and I'll never forget bursting into tears, thinking, "Why in the hell am I so lucky? Why do I have this? And this is not with Scott." And then I called him the next day. I said, "Scott, can I pick you up? Was it all right if we just spend the day?" And he said, "Sure, my mom doesn't care." So I drove right on up, and I told Mrs. Fisher, I said, "I'm going to take Scott for the day, and we're going to go." She said, "Great. Just let me know where you're going to be later on." So we're driving along, and I'm taking Scott out to this other part of Akron. And we're talking about the big book, and I'm telling him about different things that I read that my sponsor wanted me to read, the 9 paragraphs, and I'm telling Scott about this stuff. And we pull up to a golf course, and Scott's looking around like big eyes going, "Wow, what is this place?" I said, "It's a golf course." He said, "What are we doing here?" I said, "Just get out of the car." So he gets out of the car, and we go around the back, and I open up the trunk, and I said, "Here." He said, "What are those?" I said, "They're my golf clubs." He goes, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "You're going to carry them." So he puts them on. He put them on backwards. And I said, no. You know, he puts it on like this. And we go up to this thing. Now we're playing in an AA golf league that my friends and I started. Now here I am walking up to the first tee with my new guy. You know, and he's my caddy. And I can see all these other people. And they go, "Oh God, Schreiner is so sick." You know, I mean, now he's using new guys as caddies. I mean, this is bad. This is not good. You know, this is not what we mean by service work, Craig. You know. So at any rate, we played through the 9 holes, and I never forget trying to tell Scott, you know, what this golf game was. And he loved being out there. He saw all these birds and trees and things he'd never seen before. He was loving it. Well, after the end of the round, I said, "You know that book that I gave you last night?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'll put money in the thing tonight. You've just earned it, and here's $5. You earned this money." And he felt great about that. He felt great about doing something and then getting paid for it. And I never forget, it made him feel good. I said, "Well, come on, let's go over to my house, and we'll go to the meeting tonight." And we called his mom. She said, "Sure, he can stay there forever." Thinking, what did I do? So then Scotty reminded me, the next morning we woke up and he said, "Hey, could you take me down to the probation court?" I'm going, "How old are you?" He said, 14. I said, "Probation court?" He said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "I've been in and out of the detention home 22 times. And he said, "They put me in prison, but I'm too young," he said. And I'm going, "You just slept here in my house?" I'm thinking, I better go through my cupboards. Where's the stuff? You know, where's the silver? Where's the, you know, where's my VCR and all? So we went down. We go into this court. And as soon as Scott walks in, the judge looks up, and I just see him, he goes like this. And Scott goes, "Ralph, how you doing?" He's 14 years old, he's on a first-name basis with the judge. The judge goes, "What are you doing here? You're disgusting." And he looks at me and goes, "Who are you?" And I'm going, "Hey, I'm just a friend. You know, I just, I got nothing to do with this guy." And he said, "Okay," and he wrote out a thing. "You've been talking to your probate?" "No, I haven't been there." "Why haven't you been there?" And Scott, this, you know, hemming and hawing, lying, all this. Well, we started working together for the next. We were together like sun and shadow, and I didn't do anything unless Scotty was there. I just really took a liking to him, and so I remember going back to this place 6 months later, and walking into there, and Judge, "Hi, Ralph, how you doing?" And he's going, "Oh God, it's him again." And he looks at his thing and he said, "You've been at every one of your probation meetings. Your mother says you've been doing this. You've been earning money." He says, "What have you been doing?" He looks at me and goes, "What have you done to him?" I said, I haven't done anything to him. He's doing it all himself. I'm just a sponsor of his, and he goes to AA meetings. He's doing it himself. I'm just a messenger. This is not my message. You've been going to these meetings? And Scott goes, yeah, I've been doing it. And he says, I've been doing my four steps, and I've been doing these things. And Scott, now what would you do with a guy like this? He used to be part of a traveling carnival, and his dad was shot point blank. His real father was shot in a drug deal behind a, at a carnival thing, just point blown, blew his head off. And so Scott was a barker. This kid could sell like I never saw in my life. And we put him in charge of the raffle for the Young People's Conference. Now, he ended up generating something like $2,000, and we hoped he sold tickets. We had, I mean, the most anybody was able to do was like $300. I mean, $2,000. We're going, well, thanks, Scott. You know, we didn't ask where he got all the money, but we no doubt we used it. But I do remember one very interesting and one memorable experience was in front of our young people's group at the age of 15, giving Scotty, being honored to give Scotty his one-year medallion. And there's nothing greater than the sense of being just the messenger and not the message, and to be part of someone who themselves have recovered, who themselves have really taken to the water like the duck does once it hits it with the right end in the water. And I began to love the relationship with new people. I began to look forward to it. I began to accept sponsoring as part of a duty, as part of what keeps me sober. I can remember so many times talking, thinking this is hopeless, and calling my sponsor, thinking, this guy, I mean, he's calling me at night now. This other guy was spot 12:30 kid, and you know, he's calling me, and there's motorcycle gangs after him, and they're shooting him, and you know, and I asked him, I said, you know, what did you learn about borrowing somebody's Harley without asking them first, you know, and just, you know, stay away from people's wives, you know, and things, little things like that, and it works if you keep coming back, you know. And I'll never forget my sponsor just saying, you know, remember, you don't keep them sober, they keep you sober. And remember that we're only just messengers, and that we are humble servants of this power that's greater than ourselves, and it's not us to judge whether they will or won't make it. And now I can honestly say when I have the good fortune to be working with someone and someone calls me as I do my sponsor, and I say, thank you for calling, because you really helped me. I don't know if I helped you, but what you shared with me helped me today. And the part that is so fascinating to me now in recovery is learning to face life successfully. And it says I can do that. Right in that book, face life successfully. I'll never forget playing golf with my sponsor. At this point, I'm counting all the strokes. I tried a few times, deleting a few, and my sponsor said, well, now, didn't you have two swings over there and one over here and two over there? And then, oh, yeah, right, I forgot about that one. But I asked my sponsor one day when we were out playing, I said, I wonder who designs these golf courses. Isn't that interesting? Why don't we write a letter? So I wrote a letter, and I wrote a letter to a bunch of different golf course architects. Nobody responded. I wrote a letter to the United States Golf Association. Didn't get anything back. Wrote a letter. I just kept writing all these letters. Nobody would respond to anything. Finally, after about the 60th or 70th letter, this one golf course architect wrote me back and said, hey, if you're serious about getting into this golf course design, your odds are about the same as being struck by lightning, and it'll only take you 12 years, and you need to go back to college, but don't let me throw a bucket of cold water on you, you know. And I went to my sponsor and said, this is impossible. I mean, this is, nobody can do this. And we can do it one day at a time, Craig. Those were his exact words. And I wanted to strangle him. Because I was arguing for a limitation, and he wouldn't let me have that limitation. He wouldn't let me have that limitation. So I went back to college, and something was different. I was 7 years sober, and I had to take math. I had failed math every time I had taken it. I'd managed to dodge it the first time I was through college. I did not have what it took. I was convinced, and people and counselors and teachers told me that I had a problem of learning something or other, or I was hyper, or I couldn't sit still for 5 minutes. There's no way you can learn this stuff. And the very first day in math class, that's where I sat, in the front row. I didn't realize, but something was different this first day in this math class. And I was 32 years old, and everybody was 18 and 19 years old, and I was right up there in the front row. And we took this test. This teacher wanted to take an inventory of everybody in the math class so that she could be a better teacher, find out what we knew and what we didn't know. So 21 questions, filled them out, came in the next day. She went through the answers. I got three right,
I missed 18. I got the worst grade in the class. Here I'm thinking, that's it. You're done. First day in college. You're a failure. It's never going to work. Get the hell out of here. Go home. Self-pity. It's done. She said, does anybody have any questions? And my hand went. I go, what is that going on? I pulled it down. I was like those guys in the back row, back there being dumb and cool. You know what I mean? No, I didn't mean that, but that's what I was doing all my life. I was hiding. I was avoiding life, and I sat in the back row. This time it was different. I said, could you go over questions? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I forget, these guys in the back said, what's wrong with him? Something wrong with that guy? And I heard him say that, and I thought to myself, I don't care what those people say. I don't care if we're here all night. I have a right to know what I don't know about this, and I still didn't understand the questions after she went through some of them. So I went up afterwards, and I said, I don't understand some of these questions. She said, well, you need a tutor. I'm going, what? You need a sponsor? A math sponsor? She looked at me a little weird, and she said, well, yeah, I guess you could call him that. Where do you get him? I said. She said, go down to the library. Phew. I take off down the library, and I said, I'm looking for math sponsors, you know? And they said, well, tutors are over here. And I started to work with this tutor. She was a very bright person, and she introduced herself. We started to talk, and she tried to explain some questions, and I didn't quite understand them. But I did this homework that she asked me to, and I came back the next day. And then she started to ask me a little more about my past and what I liked and didn't like. And as she got to know me, she knew how I thought, so she could explain things to me a little differently. She could make connections as we got to know each other. Well, next thing I know, I started to understand some of these things she was talking about. And I did my homework every night, and I went to class every day. Something weird happens when you do that. You get extra credit, you know? What the hell is extra credit? I never got extra credit for anything. You only go a couple days, quit, and then, you know, you're with the rest of the guys that are dumb and cool in the back row. But I got extra credit, and I never forget taking the first test, and I got a C, and then I realized that I made dumb mistakes. I knew the answer to these things, and the teacher said, you know, you did know how to do that, I could tell, but she said, have you taken the course on how to take a test? I go, what? There's a course on how to take it? Well, yeah. Didn't you go to orientation? I said, nah, that's for weirdos, is what I'm thinking. So I went and took this orientation thing, and I learned how to take a test. So now when I went and took the second math test, I got an A on it. And then I got another, and I never forget the last day. Last week, the big Ohio State-Michigan game was on, and there was the dilemma. Go to the biggest game in the country, or do the 100-and-some questions that you're supposed to for the final math exam. And you know what? I did the 100-and-some questions for the final math exam. I figured, what the heck, I can miss one of these games. And I went to the library. Library was empty, but I was in there, and I went through every single one of those. I took the test that following Monday, and I got 173 right out of 175, and I got an A on the math test. First thing I thought of was I beat myself for missing those two. Sobriety is bittersweet sometimes. I was having problems in chemistry, and I thought, what's the deal? Don't know. Chemistry sponsor. So I had a chemistry sponsor. Next thing I know, I was doing great in that. Now, what did I do the very next year? The next year, I was a math sponsor. The next year, I was a chemistry sponsor. And you really want to learn something? Teach it. And where did I learn that? Where did I learn that? Right here. Now, something had happened to me this second time in college. I was different. I was enjoying this experience. I was facing life successfully. I was asking questions. I was being alert. I had a joke for the day. Every day I went through the line in the cafeteria, and there were these four women that would serve these meals up to these 18 and 19-year-olds that didn't want to be there. They hated the place. They didn't have anything nice to say, and I always have a joke for the day. And I know they thought I was on drugs the first couple of weeks, you know, because nobody is this, you know, hyped up about anything, you know. And at the end of the first year, Mabel, the head cook, big German woman, she would look at you and measure how many mashed potatoes you would get by the size of your head. You know what I mean? And she said, do you have a place to live next year? And I said, no, I haven't looked yet. And she said, well, you know, we have a place out at the farm that we rent out. And I've been looking at you, and I like you. And she said, why don't you come on out and check it out, and if you'd like it, you can rent. So I remember driving out to this place south of campus, and it was like a 1,200-acre farm. And it had all these different orchards, and it had ponds, and it had silos, and there were cows and sheep and pigs and all these different kinds of animals. And it was just a beautiful setting. This old, old house set up on the hill. It was beautiful. And she took me upstairs on the second floor, just completely been renovated, the whole thing. And she said, well, this is where you would stay. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way I can afford this. I mean, I don't have the money for this. And so as we were walking downstairs, I said, well, Mabel, how much does this cost? She says, I've been watching you for the last year, and I like you. There's something about you that's different. She says, you can live here for free. As a matter of fact, I'll feed you all your meals, but there's one thing I'd like you to do. If it snows, will you shovel the walk? And I'll never forget, I was president of the student body, elected by my peers, and as that privilege, I was able to talk at commencement. And the lieutenant governor for the state of Ohio talked, and he was boring. And the dean of the university talked, and he was boring. And I got up, and I talked. And after I had talked about the different scholarships that I had gotten, I had two different academic scholarships, Living Life and Facing It Successfully, I talked about the third one that meant more to me than anything of all these other ones, and that was the one that I got from Mabel, because that scholarship came from her heart. That one was treasured more than anything else that I could muster up. I'll never forget at the end of that talk that this whole audience stood and applauded thunderously over what they thought was the most profound talk that they'd ever heard. And it was the indispensables to learning: honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to change. Page 570, the spiritual appendix. That's what I talked about. And my dad was in the front row, and for the first time he said, "That's my son." I can remember he said, "Nope, don't know him, officer. Never seen him before." Getting caught stealing things when I had the money to pay for, you know, out damaging this, thrown out of school, little Mr. Hyper, you know. That's my son. And all I talked about was honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness to change. And in May of 1989, I was inducted into the American Society of Golf Course Architects. I was inducted into a society of golf course architects where there are less than 100 at the time in the world. And in less than a month, I will be leaving for mainland China to probably design the first golf course in the middle of China. And the very first thing that I did when I was we were having a fundraiser at my home group for Intergroup, because I know where it is now, and we had the three ladies from Intergroup to talk that night, and I went up to Charlotte and I said, "Charlotte, I got this thing where it looks like I'm going to the China," and she immediately, the next thing I know, she's got the international directory, and she's already got a meeting for me in Hong Kong, and I was thinking, well, I could start the Unity Group Far East, you know, that'd be kind of interesting, but my point in all this was that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship that's all over the world. It encompasses different races and creeds and ages and sexes and colors. It doesn't matter. It's an umbrella cast over the humanity of the derelicts of society, those people that I thought that I was better than. And it's only through getting down on my knees and asking God for help every single day to help me in what I do in sobriety, that I only be a vehicle, that I only be a messenger, that I only somehow be of service. And today I let the sunlight of God into my life, and there isn't a thing I don't think that I don't do or I don't ask His help first in some sort of small silent prayer, just as I did before I even got up here tonight to share at this 16th roundup. And facing life successfully is really one of the challenges that I have today. And I truly realize that in all humility that it's only through a gift of you people and your love and your acceptance that I'm able to stand here today and talk to you and to be a part of a slate of different speakers that have equally tremendous success stories in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was back in college, one time I was at the College of Worcester. And I was at this library that stayed open later than the one at Ohio State. I was actually hanging out in libraries till 1 in the morning. And they have a set of dictionaries there, the Cambridge Unabridged Dictionaries. And for every letter, there is an entire volume. I remember when I went on that trip to New York, to Ikipop, to talk. And we went to Intergroup, and we went to World Service Headquarters, where the Grapevine is and all that. And I remember seeing on the wall this letter from Dr. Young that he had written to Bill Wilson. And this is the guy that was talking to Roland on page 27. And he was saying, "Mr. Wilson, appreciate you writing to me, asking about this spiritual experience that you're inquiring about. But in all honesty, I can't really tell you in psychoanalytic terms what a spiritual experience is. I can't explain to you in theological terms what a spiritual experience is." He says, "But I was able to look up the word alcohol, and I traced it to its origin. It's a Latin derivative called spiritus. And somewhere, you know, I don't know what, maybe like the 16th century, when they, you know, started to squish a lot of grapes, make a lot of that juice, the knights of the round table would drink this stuff, chase the women around the table all night, forget where they left their lance, you know, and their horse, and, you know, not knowing where the horse was the next morning, and they got a weird taste in their mouth, and they can't figure out what's going on, and they're thinking, what the heck did that? And they said, well, it's the spirits in this wine. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know that it was an alcoholic molecule, and then they called spiritus. It was a Latin word. So really, we should be Spiritus Anonymous, I guess is what we really should be called, but... But I'll never forget looking up that word. I remember when I was in that library about that word, and I said, well, geez, I wonder if that's in here. And I looked up the word alcohol in this unabridged dictionary. Sure enough, about six or seven definitions down, it says Latin spiritus. So I said, well, what's that word mean? And I kept reading down further and further and further, and it means the breath of life. And isn't that what was in that very first drink that I had when I was 13 years old that just made everything go away, that was so exciting, that just grabbed me and made that thing? It was the breath of life. That's what it instilled in me. That's what that alcohol was. However, it turned on me somewhere and realized that that was the essence of what was really inside me, but only God and this fellowship could bring that out. And all of a sudden, my mind was in a fit of open-mindedness. I'll never forget. It was a weird feeling. And I thought, you know, everybody's always told me that I was hyper. And everybody's always told me that, you know, the counselor says he's hyper, and the psychologist says he's hyper, and the psychiatrist says he's hyper. And why can't you sit down when you watch television? And he's bored in school, and he's a problem, and, you know, get him out of here. And, you know, my sponsor told me I was enthusiastic. I'll never forget when I first met him and I was making an ass out of myself. You know, I said, George, why didn't you stop me when you knew that I was thought you were a new person and I was making a fool out of myself, and you were letting me kiss. You were beautiful, he said. All this enthusiasm, you were just beautiful, he said. So there I was in the library, and I looked up that word enthusiasm. What is that word? And I looked it up, and I, sure enough, in this unabridged dictionary, it goes through all the meanings, and it gets down to a Greek word meaning ethios. And it means inspired by God. And that is the quality that I have. I'm not hyper. All those people were wrong. I got my definition. I am the breath of life inspired by God, and I am nothing less than that. And there's quite a distance from that guy in Molly Stark who was thinking he was better than those amoebas in society to now believing today, and not in the delusion that I'm going to drink normal like everybody else, but believing today that I am the breath of life inspired by God, and I've been given this gift of sobriety through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it's tempting up here to think that you really know what you're talking about after you get up here and you see all these smiling faces. And I'll never forget when I was on one of those spiritual dry drunks early in my sobriety, and I'd gotten done talking at a young people's conference, and I was out in the concourse afterwards, and you know, women were coming up to me saying, I have a daughter I'd like you to meet. And I'm going, boy, that's different. You know, they used to say, stay away from the Shriner kid, he's trouble, you know. Don't you go near him. And I was sucking up all these, you know, accolades and all these nice endorsements and all these compliments and everything. And the guy that talked the night before was this huge hillbilly from Tennessee. His name was Billy Am. And this guy drank for like 20 years, and he'd never even seen a bar in his whole life. He drank stuff that came in a ball jar that was White Lightning, and he'd never ever... The only time he went to a bar was to pick up a drunk to take him to a meeting. And he was standing behind me when I was out there sucking up all this applause and all this attention and all this sort of stuff, sort of thinking I really knew what I was talking about. And he said, Craig? Kind of, you know, scared me a little bit. I almost spilled my coffee. And I said, oh, hey, Billy, how you doing? And I wouldn't even look at him. You know, I was sucking up all this stuff. And he said, hey, what's the most useless thing in AA? And I'm thinking, God, I don't know. What? And he said, that's a speaker who's already spoken.